Hey y'all, welcome to this week's episode of Unfit to Print, and of course, Happy New Year. I'm your host, Amber Athey. I'm the Daily Caller's White House correspondent and a Tony Blankley Fellow with the Steamboat Institute. As always, if you haven't subscribed already, please subscribe to our YouTube, iTunes, and SoundCloud channels. Enter Sandman, he who laughs last, laughs loudest. And the Covington kid is about to be laughing all the way to the bank with a massive CNN check in his pocket. WAPO steps in it with Stefanik. We're supposed to believe that all of a sudden they care about doctored photos? The wrong shill to die on. No one's surprised some media members seem to take Iran's side after Soleimani, but we've compiled the most egregious examples of US journos spreading Iranian propaganda. Stop, drop, and delete your tweet. What do you do if you can blame climate change for wildfires? Tweet some fake news, says ABC's social media team. Remember when a bunch of CNN personalities decided to go after teenagers because they allegedly were harassing a Native American elderly man? Well, remember, these were the kids from Covington Catholic High School, and they were in DC for a field trip, and some of them were wearing MAGA hats. As it turned out, they were being harassed by a group of Black nationalists and decided to start some school chants in order to drown out some of the racist things that those individuals were saying to them. In the throw of all of this, Native American Nathan Phillips started beating a drum in one of the kid's faces, causing the kid to just stand there and smile at him in a way of trying to defuse the situation. Well, the Covington Catholic kids and Nicholas Sandman, who was the kid with the so-called assault smirk, were maligned by the media for allegedly being racist towards this Native American man. What actually happened, of course, is that their only crime was supporting Trump and being young, white, religious Americans. Well, Nicholas Sandman sued a number of media outlets for their coverage of him over alleged defamation, and we just found out that CNN has decided to settle its lawsuit with Nicholas Sandman. Now, we don't know how much Nicholas got out of this lawsuit. He confirmed that they did settle, but he was seeking hundreds of millions of dollars from CNN, and we don't have the exact number of how much money they actually settled for, but it seems like this is a great first step in holding these establishment media outlets accountable when they decide to use their bias to publish defamatory and false things about people who happen to be on the right side of the political spectrum. Political reporters at the Washington Post are apparently getting a bit bored with their day jobs, and now they're going after Republican congresswomen for allegedly altering photos of Nancy Pelosi. Today, a political reporter for WAPO decided to write an entire article about the fact that Elise Stefanik had used a somewhat photoshopped or filtered image of the Speaker of the House in a fundraising advertisement for the GOP. Now, the image is pretty standard political advertisement fodder. The contrast is increased a lot. Pelosi looks really dark and ominous. It's a very classic move for politicians to add these types of filters on images, of course, to make their opponents look like they're being presented in a more negative fashion. But the Washington Post acted like this was a major crime by Elise Stefanik. A number of conservatives responded to the Washington Post article, pointing out the number of other times that politicians on the left have done this to people on the right. In fact, just the morning before the Washington Post called out Stefanik for this photo of Pelosi, they had published a really contrasting black and white photo of some Republican members like Mark Meadows, Jody Heiss, and Andy Biggs. So Washington Post was apparently guilty of the same thing that they were criticizing a Republican for. You have ads by Tom Steyer that show Trump looking in a very similar fashion to Pelosi. You have the lines on his face very exaggerated, horrible angles, really high contrast. Nancy Pelosi has done the same exact thing to Mitch McConnell, where she puts a black shroud around his face, and the contrast is really bumped up so that he looks more negative, more like a villain. So this Washington Post reporter who published this article ended up getting ratioed for the fact that she thought this was an important thing to focus on. And of course, for the double standard employed by the Washington Post and Democrats for being concerned about this picture of Pelosi. Now, we all know why the Washington Post decided to go after Elise Stefanik. The timing is just too obvious. She has long been a more moderate person in the Republican Party. She's representative of a district in New York, and she's a young woman. Now, she came out very pro-Trump during the impeachment inquiry in the House and was one of his most ardent defenders. She got a lot of airtime out of it. And the people on the left in the media were very upset about this and basically saw her as a traitor to feminism and to centrism, because if you're a Republican, you can't actually be conservative. Otherwise, the left is going to vilify you. So right after she decided to defend Trump during the impeachment inquiry, the Washington Post publishes this hit piece about an image she chose to use for an advertisement. The timing is just very suspect. And of course, we also learned this week that Stefanik had a major fundraising haul after she decided to stand up for Trump, and her opponent was actually being pushed forward by the media in the wake of Stefanik's support for Trump. So it seems like the media's decision to go after Stefanik is backfiring big time. And this article by the Washington Post is really just the latest example. If you all paid any attention to the news this week, you know that the media was predicting World War III over the latest set of conflicts between the United States and Iran. Many people in the media claim that Trump's temper and his instability was going to get the U.S. into another Middle Eastern war. And some of them seem to even actually be wishing for that, because it would be a broken promise from Trump, because he campaigned on getting rid of these endless wars that didn't benefit Americans. As it turned out, Trump's response to all of this was actually really measured. And because the media could not blame him for getting us into another unnecessary war, they decided their next best course of action was to shill for Iran. Now, just a brief timeline of everything that's gone on over the past couple of weeks. All of this started because Iran was behind some missile strikes that ended up injuring multiple people and killing an American contractor, an American citizen. So the U.S. responded by launching some defensive strikes. And then Iran and Iraqi protesters decided to storm the U.S. embassy in Iraq, which led to pulling out of the U.S. diplomat to Iraq and sending in a number of Marines to try to secure the embassy. There was a lot of damage. They were setting fires to the embassy. It was a total mess. So then the United States responded to the storming of the embassy by taking out Qasem Soleimani, who is basically a top military leader in Iran. And he was allegedly planning an imminent attack on U.S. forces in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, and was also apparently behind orchestrating the protest on the embassy, which led to the damage and potential dangers to U.S. diplomats. So it was not a major bombing or an act of war by Trump's estimation. This was a way to respond proportionately to what Iran was doing to try to provoke the United States. Iran then responded again by launching missiles at U.S. bases in the area. No one got injured. There was very minimal damage, according to the Department of Defense. So all of this amounted to basically a fireworks show by Iran. Trump again responded by offering them a chance at peace, a new Iran deal that would take over the one created during the Obama administration, and also placing stronger sanctions on Iran. So at the end of the day, we've had a tit for tat, as we normally do with Iran, because they're not big fans of the United States, but we ended without any new war and without a major escalation of military conflict. Definitely not what the media was expecting. So, moving on, I know all this is a bit, in the weeds, but the main issue here was the fact that the media spent all of this time, as this escalation or lack thereof was happening, spreading Iranian propaganda and undermining U.S. intelligence and the president's foreign policy decisions with their own reporting. The New York Times was perhaps the chief pusher of the Iranian propaganda. They had several articles throughout the week, including Soleimani's obituary, where they called him a master of Iran's intrigue, praising his charisma. They had another piece pointing out how large the crowds were that came out for Soleimani's funeral. Another person who was in awe of the crowd size for Soleimani's funeral was MSNBC's Katie Turr. Of course, none of these individuals mentioned the fact that attendance at these types of public events in Iran, these types of protests, is compulsory. Watch Katie Ter's take on this.
A stunning show of solidarity just a few weeks after anti-government protests threatened to destabilize the country. It seems President Trump did what the Iranian government has been unable to do, unite the country. Ayatollah Khomeini wept as he eulogized Soleimani, and Soleimani's successor vowed revenge. The country is taking steps to remove itself from the nuclear deal that President Trump pulled out of 2 years ago now.
Luckily, an Iranian journalist writing for the Washington Post parsed all this out, explaining that people are often forced to attend these events. School children were apparently told to write essays praising Soleimani for their classes. They were given extra credit or even just straight up class credit for attending the funeral. This is what happens in a dictatorial state like this, in an authoritarian state, is that if people don't go out and protest, they are met with consequences from the regime that's in place there. So talking about the crowd sizes in that context is not actually, one, useful, or two, very patriotic, because you are directly giving fodder to the Iranian regime and their propaganda efforts. MSNBC host Chris Matthews was interviewing a Tehran bureau chief named Ali Arouzi, and in the aftermath of those Iranian missile strikes on the U.S. Bases, he used the state media in Iran's claim that there had been 30 American casualties in the aftermath of the missile strikes. Now, to their credit, they mentioned that those were unconfirmed reports, but repeating Iranian state media like that without any of your own reporting is so irresponsible. Watch.
This bit I'm not sure about, but the Iran state media is claiming that 30 U.S. soldiers have been killed in this attack. Now, this is not confirmed. This is just coming from Iranian media.
Now, we later found out from the Department of Defense that there were actually no casualties and very minimal damage in the aftermath of these missile strikes. And this was basically an attempt by Iran to save face, showing their people that they were making some show of force to the United States after the death of Soleimani. But again, no actual damage to the United States. And that was what led to Trump's response to basically stand down and place some more economic sanctions on them rather than responding with another escalation of force, which would have probably been taking Iran's bait and leading us further into war. Time Magazine decided that this entire encounter was the perfect opportunity to lecture parents about how to teach their children about what is going on in foreign policy with an article titled, quote, "How to Talk to Your Kids About the Situation with Iran." Now, I'm not a mother, but I would imagine that it's pretty simple. Iran has been enabling terrorism for a number of years, and a really bad guy who has killed hundreds of Americans was struck by the U.S. and killed. Pretty simple. But Time decides to talk about Iran in vaunted language and gloss over a huge part of the conflict that was Iran's doing, and instead basically make it sound like Trump is going crazy and we're all going to die. So pretty typical with how these leftists talk to their kids and fearmonger against the president. Now, CNN, in the midst of all of this, was hosting an Iranian government official to talk about all of these conflicts that were going on. And this individual who was brought on to talk about this conflict was the spokesperson for students who held 52 American diplomats hostage during the 1979 crisis. Watch.
And what pressure will that put on your leadership in terms of responding?
I'm saying that the American government, the American president, made a serious miscalculation. They made a serious mistake by assassinating, by taking this terrorist action against Commander Soleimani.
Christiane Amanpour was the person conducting this interview, and not only did she not acknowledge that this individual was the spokesperson for those students who held Americans hostage, but she also hardly pushed back on her assertion that it was a terrorist action to kill Soleimani, who the U.S. does in fact consider to be a member of a terrorist organization. Overall, the media spent this week proving their pure hatred for this president, and perhaps to some extent even the United States, by failing to recognize that this very well could have been a justified killing of Soleimani, and then fear-mongering about what was going to happen next. I think it's pretty clear to most people that this was a measured action, a response to Iran poking the bear, but it was a response that did not bring us really any closer to war as far as we can tell at this point. This seemed to be the type of foreign policy that Trump has been promising since he was campaigning in 2016, which is, yes, being forceful on the world stage, but also not getting the U.S. into unnecessary conflicts, and certainly ones that are not beneficial to the American people. ABC News decided to fearmonger about the scale of the Australian wildfires this week by publishing a completely misleading graphic that suggested the entire country was on fire. Now, this graphic basically took each individual fire, drew a line around them, and then shaded it in with orange. So they ended up, of course, shading in the entire country of Australia. And then they superimposed that graphic on top of the United States. Now, this was supposed to show, you know, how far the fires were spread out across the country, but it ended up giving the impression that all of Australia was on fire after a number of people, including myself, called out this graphic for how misleading it was. ABC News actually deleted it and issued the following correction. Now, this is not to say that the Australian wildfires are not a serious issue. I'm certainly thinking of everyone who is in their path, just as we see in wildfires in California and the like. It's a horrible situation. But the idea that news outlets are trying to use this for a political agenda, such as promoting responses to climate change and other similar political ideologies, it just seems like it's irresponsible and another attempt to try to spread fake news to the American people. Finally, Paul Krugman, a New York Times contributor and a Pulitzer Prize-winning economist, had a pretty insane tweet this week alleging that someone was using his IP address to download kiddie porn. Now, this tweet is a CYA if I've ever seen one. He said, quote, "Well, I'm on the phone with my computer security service, and as I understand it, someone compromised my IP address and is using it to download child pornography. I might just be a random target, but this could be an attempt to QAnon me. It's an ugly world out there. I don't know what it means to be QAnon, but this seems like he's trying to either get out ahead of something, or maybe he actually is the victim of a targeted person, targeted crime of someone trying to frame him for child pornography. Regardless, it's a really strange thing to tweet." He actually later deleted it and said that the New York Times told him this could have been a scam or spam phone call and that his IP address wasn't actually compromised. But this reminds me so much of when Kurt Eichenwald was trying to go after people, conservatives on Twitter and ended up accidentally posting a screenshot of his tabs open on his browser that showed he was looking at weird things like tentacle porn. It's just never a good idea to tweet about any type of porn whatsoever because chances are you're going to get made fun of, and it's better to just leave that to your own private self, I think. But that's all we have for you this week. Thank you all so much for watching. Happy New Year. Welcome back. And we will see you for next week's episode of Unfit to Print.